Harper Audio presents Brief Candle in the Dark, My Life in Science, by Richard Dawkins, read by the author. Out, out, brief candle! Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. William Shakespeare, Macbeth, Act 5, Scene 5. Science as a Candle in the Dark. Carl Sagan, subtitle to The Demon-Haunted World, 1995. Better to light a candle than curse the darkness. Anon. Flashback at a Feast. What am I doing here in New College Hall, about to read my poem to 100 dinner guests? How did I get here? A subjective 25-year-old, objectively bewildered to find himself celebrating his 70th circuit of the sun. Looking around the long candle-lit table with its polished silver and sparkling wine glasses, reflecting flashes of wit and sparkling sentences, I indulge my mind in a series of quick-firing flashbacks. Back to childhood in colonial Africa amid big lazy butterflies, the peppery taste of nasturtium leaves stolen from the lost Lilongwe garden. The taste of mango, more than sweet, spiced by a whiff of turpentine and sulphur. Boarding school in the pine-scented Vumba Mountains of Zimbabwe, and then back home, in England, beneath the heavenward spires of Salisbury and Arundel. Undergraduate days, damsel dreaming among Oxford's punts and spires, and the dawning of an interest in science and the deep philosophical questions which only science can answer. Early forays into research and teaching at Oxford and Berkeley. The return to Oxford as an eager young lecturer. More research, mostly collaborating with my first wife, Marion, whom I can see at the table here in New College. And then my first book, The Selfish Gene. Those swift memories take me to the age of 35, halfway to today's landmark birthday. They milestone the years covered by my first book of memoirs, An Appetite for Wonder. My 35th birthday recalled to me an article by the humorist Alan Corran about his own. Corran was mock-depressed by the thought that he had reached half-time and it was now downhill all the way. I didn't feel the same, perhaps because I was just putting the finishing touches to my first, rather youthful book, and was looking forward to publication and its aftermath. One aspect of that aftermath was being pitchforked by the unexpectedly high sales of the book into the company of those who are regularly asked by journalists scratching around for column inches to list their ideal gathering of dinner party guests. In the days when I used to respond to that kind of request, I would invite some great scientists as a matter of course, but also writers and creative spirits of all kinds. Indeed, any of those lists would probably have included at least 15 of those actually attending my birthday dinner today, among them novelists, playwrights, television personalities, musicians, comedians, historians, publishers, actors, and multinational business tycoons. 35 years ago, I think to myself, as I spot familiar faces around the table, such a mix of literary and artistic guests at a scientist's birthday dinner would have seemed unlikely. Has the zeitgeist changed since C.P. Snow lamented the chasm between scientific and literary culture? What has happened in the years covered by my dinnertime musing? My reverie jumps me into the middle of the period, and I conjure the giant unforgettable figure of Douglas Adams, sadly absent from the feast. In 1996, when I was 55 and he 10 years younger, I had a televised conversation with him for a Channel 4 documentary called Break the Science Barrier. The programme's purpose was precisely to show that science needed to burst into the wider culture, and my interview with Douglas was the high spot. Here is part of what he said. I think the role of the novel has changed a little bit. In the 19th century, the novel was where you went to get your serious reflections and questionings about life. You go to Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Nowadays, of course, you know the scientists actually tell much more about such issues than you would ever get from novelists. So I think that for the real solid red meat of what I read, I go to science books and read some novels for light relief. Could this be a part of what has changed? Have novelists, journalists, and others of the kind C.P. Snow would have planted firmly in his first culture increasingly come to embrace the second? Might Douglas, if he were still living, now go back to the novel and uncover some of what he had moved to science to find 25 years after he had read English at Cambridge? Ian McEwan, say, or A.S. Byatt, or other novelists who love science, such as Philip Pullman, or Martin Amis, William Boyd, or Barbara Kingsolver. Then there are highly successful science-inspired plays in the tradition of Tom Stoppard and Michael Frayn. Could this starry dinner party, put together for me by my wife Lala Ward, an artist and actress herself well read in science, be some kind of symbol of a change in the culture, as well as a personal landmark in my life? Are we witnessing a constructive merger between scientific and literary cultures, perhaps the third culture towards which my literary agent John Brockman has been working behind the scenes as he nurses his online salon and grows his glittering list of science authors? Or the merging of cultures that I aspired to in my own Unweaving the Rainbow, where, under the influence of Lala, I tried to reach out to the world of literature and bridge the gap from science. Où sont les C.P. Snow's d'antan? Two anecdotes tell, and if you don't like digressive anecdotes, you might find you're listening to the wrong book. One of my guests at this New College dinner, the explorer and adventurer Redmond O'Hanlon, author of grotesquely funny travel books such as Into the Heart of Borneo and In Trouble Again, would throw literary parties and dinners with his wife Belinda, to which, it seemed, the whole of literary London was invited. Novelists and critics, journalists and editors, poets and publishers, literary agents and literary lions descended on their remote corner of the Oxfordshire countryside, the house crammed full of stuffed snakes, shrunken heads, leathery corpses and leather-bound books, exotic curios of anthropology and, one suspects, anthropophagy. These evenings were always notable for the company and, when it included Salman Rushdie, for the bodyguards keeping their own company upstairs. On one of these occasions, Lala and I happened to have staying with us Nathan Mervold, Chief Technology Officer at Microsoft, and one of the most inventive geeks of Silicon Valley. Nathan is a mathematical physicist by training. After his PhD at Princeton, he worked in Cambridge with Stephen Hawking during the period when Stephen was still just capable of talking, though not intelligibly to any but his close associates, who acted as interpreters for the benefit of the rest of the world. Nathan became one of these highly qualified physicist amanuenses. True to his promise, he's now one of high-tech's most innovative thinkers. When Redmond and Belinda invited us, we told them we had a house guest, and they, hospitable as ever, told us to bring him along. Nathan is too polite to monopolise a conversation. His neighbours at the long table presumably asked him what he did, and the conversation grew into a discussion of string theory and other arcana of modern physics. And the literary illuminati were held spellbound. They began, as usual, no doubt, exchanging aphoristic wit with their neighbours. But inexorably, a wave of curious interest in science swept from Nathan's end down the long table, and the evening became a kind of informal seminar on the weirdness of modern physics. When a seminar includes intelligences of the calibre of this bunch of dinner companions, interesting things happen. Lala and I basked in reflected glory as sponsors of the unexpected guest at this archetypal third culture evening. And afterwards, Redmond telephoned and told Lala that never in all his years of throwing such parties had he seen his eminent literary guests reduced to such stunned silence. The second anecdote is almost a mirror image. The playwright and novelist Michael Frayn came with his wife, the distinguished writer Claire Tomalin, to stay with Lala and me when his remarkable play Copenhagen was being performed at the Oxford Playhouse. The play is about the relationship between two giants of modern physics, Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg, and about a riddle in the history of science. Why did Heisenberg visit Bohr in Copenhagen in 1941? And what was Heisenberg's role in the war? After the performance, Michael was conducted to an upper room in the playhouse, where he was quizzed by the assembled physicists of Oxford. It was a privilege to hear this aristocrat of literary and philosophical learning field questions from the cream of Oxford scientists, including several fellows of the Royal Society. Once again, an evening for third culture warriors to treasure, an evening to surprise and delight the C.P. Snow of 30 years earlier. I dare to hope that my books, starting with The Selfish Gene in 1976, are among those that change the cultural landscape, along with the works of Stephen Hawking, Peter Atkins, Carl Sagan, Edward O. Wilson, Steve Jones, Stephen Jay Gould, Steven Pinker, Richard Forty, Lawrence Krauss, Daniel Kahneman, Helena Cronin, Daniel Dennett, Brian Greene, the two M. Ridleys, Mark and Matt, the two Sean Carrolls, physicist and biologist, Victor Stenger and others, and the critical and journalistic buzz that they engendered. I'm not talking about science journalists explaining science to the lay public, although that's a good thing as well. I'm talking about books by professional scientists, aimed at professionals in their own and other disciplines, but written in language such that the general reading public can look over their shoulders and join in. I'd like to think that I might have been one of those who helped to kick-start this third culture. Unlike An Appetite for Wonder, this second volume of my autobiography is not simply chronological, not even a single flashback from my 70th birthday. Rather, it is a series of flashbacks, divided into themes, punctuated by digression and anecdote. Since we are dispensing with rigid chronology, the order of themes is somewhat arbitrary. I said in the first volume that, insofar as anything was the making of me, Oxford was. So why not start with my return to those glowing limestone walls? Oh, the things that are done by a Don. From 1970 to 1990, I was university lecturer in animal behaviour in the zoology department at Oxford, promoted to reader from 1990 to 1995. The lecturing duties were not especially onerous, at least by American standards. As well as lecturing on animal behaviour, I was one of those who inaugurated a new option in evolution. Evolution had always, of course, been a core feature of the course, but the new option allowed students the opportunity to take deeper advantage of Oxford's long-time expertise in the subject. In addition to students reading zoology or biological sciences, I lectured to those reading human science and psychology, both of which were honour schools with an examination paper in animal behaviour. I also gave an annual service course for zoology students on computer programming. Incidentally, this showed up an astonishing variance in student ability, a far wider gap between the strongest and the weakest than I ever noticed in the rest of their course. The weakest never really got it, despite my best efforts, and despite the fact that they had no trouble with the non-computational parts of the course. The strongest? Well, Kate Lessels turned up late for the practical class, having missed all the sessions in the first half of the term. I protested. You've never touched a computer before, and you've missed 4 weeks. How can you expect to do today's practical exercise? What did you say in the lectures? Was the imperturbable reply of this steady-eyed, tomboyish young woman. I was baffled. You really mean you want me to condense 4 weeks of lectures into 5 minutes? She nodded, still imperturbable, and with what might have been an ironic half-smile. Right, I said, and I'm not sure whether I thought I was issuing a challenge to her or a challenge to myself. You asked for this. I did condense 4 hours of lectures into 5 minutes. She simply nodded after every sentence without taking a note and without speaking a word. Then this formidably clever young woman sat down at the console, completed the exercise, and left the room. That at least is my memory of what occurred. I may be exaggerating a little, but nothing in Kate's subsequent career leads me to think so. Apart from lecturing and running practical classes in the Department of Zoology, my other teaching duties consisted of tutorials. These I conducted in New College, it was new in 1379, today one of Oxford's oldest, where I became a fellow in 1970. Most lecturers and professors at Oxford and Cambridge are also fellows of one of the 30 or 40 semi-independent colleges or halls that make up these two federal universities. My salary was paid partly by the University of Oxford, where my duties consisted mostly of lecturing and researching in the Department of Zoology, and partly by New College, for which I had to do a minimum of 6 hours tutoring per week, often of students from other colleges, by exchange arrangement with their own tutors, which was the normal practice in the biological sciences, though not so much in other subjects. Tutorials were usually one-on-one when I started teaching, although paired tutorials gradually became more common. As an undergraduate myself, I had loved the tutorial system, and had far preferred one-on-one tutorials, in which I would read my essay aloud to the tutor, who would either take notes and then discuss it, or interrupt the reading to comment. Nowadays, Oxford tutors are more likely to take two or even three students at a time in the same hour, and essays are typically not read aloud, but handed in and read ahead of time. Through my early years at New College, our pupils were all male. In 1974, those of us in the fellowship who wanted to admit women narrowly failed to secure the necessary two-thirds majority. Some of the opposition was frankly misogynistic. The most deplorable examples have now, thankfully, long receded into the past, so there's no need for me to repeat their awful arguments. I was pleased to be able to deploy statistics in a college meeting to annul some of their more egregious claims about the academic abilities of women. In fact, we won the first vote in 1974 to change our statutes and make the admission of women possible. But, a typical parliamentary manoeuvre, the price of victory was a concession. We agreed to hold a separate subsequent vote the following term on the actual admission of women undergraduates. We presumed that the second vote would go our way too, but it didn't. Whether those opponents who bargained the concession had cleverly foreseen the absence of a crucial voter on sabbatical leave in America, I don't know. But the upshot was that New College was unexpectedly not among the first five male colleges to admit women, although we were among the first to change our statutes to allow us to do so, and the college was the very first, long before my time, formally to debate it. We didn't achieve the final step until 1979, along with the majority of Oxford's other colleges. Though we couldn't admit women students in 1974, our change of statutes did allow us to elect women fellows. Unfortunately, the first woman we elected, though a distinguished scholar in her field, showed signs of being pretty misogynistic herself. She wasn't fond of female students or female junior colleagues, as I learned from one of them who became a close friend of mine. We were more fortunate in subsequent elections, and New College is now a flourishing mixed-sex community, with all the benefits that that brings. New recruits. One of my most grievous responsibilities was to admit young biologists to New College in the first place. What was hard was the obligation to turn down so many good and keen candidates because the competition was so severe. Every November, from all around Britain and far beyond, crowds of eager young people descend on Oxford for their interviews, many of them noticeably shivering with cold in their thin, unaccustomed suits. The colleges put them up in student rooms, which had been vacated by all the incumbent undergraduates, except a few volunteers who stay behind as shepherds to look after them, show them around, and try to make sure that cold is all they shiver from. In addition to interviewing candidates, until it was abolished, I also had to read their answers to the Oxford entrance examination and contribute to setting the questions for that quirkily idiosyncratic paper. Why do animals have heads? Why has the cow got four legs and the milking stool three? Neither of those two questions was mine, by the way. In both the entrance exam and the interviews, we were not after factual knowledge for its own sake. Exactly what we were testing is harder to define. Intelligence, yes, but not just IQ-type intelligence. I suppose it was something like ability to reason constructively in the particular ways required by the subject, in my case biology. Lateral thinking, biological intuition, maybe teachability, even an attempt to assess, would it be a rewarding experience to teach this person? And is this the kind of person who would benefit from an Oxbridge education, especially from our unique tutorial system? Here's a digression whose relevance will become apparent. In 1998, I was invited to present the trophy at the final of University Challenge. This is a general knowledge quiz show on BBC television in which representatives of universities, the colleges of Oxford and Cambridge are treated as separate entities for this purpose, compete in a complicated form of knockout competition. The standard of general knowledge displayed can be astonishingly high. The popular Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is very low grade by comparison and presumably gains its appeal from the element of gambling for large rewards. In my speech in Manchester, presenting the trophy to the 1998 winners of University Challenge, Magdalen College, Oxford, who defeated Birkbeck, London, in the final, I said, according to a quote in Wikipedia which agrees with my memory, I'm conducting a campaign at Oxford with my colleagues to make them abolish the A-level, the nationwide school-leaving exam, which tests specialist knowledge, as the criterion for admitting students, and substitute University Challenge. I'm very serious about this. The kind of mind you need to win University Challenge. It's not the knowledge that matters, but it's the retentive mind to pick things up wherever you are that you need at university too. I told a story of an undergraduate studying history at Oxford who was unable to find Africa on a map of the world. When I said to a colleague that she should never have been admitted to our, or any, university, he protested that maybe she'd missed the relevant geography lesson at school. That is precisely not the point. If you need a geography lesson in order to know where Africa is, if, by age 17, you've somehow failed to imbibe such knowledge by osmosis or simple curiosity, you surely don't have the sort of mind that would benefit from a university education. That's an extreme illustration of why I suggested a university challenge-style general knowledge test as part of our entrance procedure. Not general knowledge for its own sake, but general knowledge as a litmus test for a teachable mind. My suggestion, tongue somewhat but not wholly in cheek, has yet to be taken seriously. But Oxford did, still does, make an effort to test more than just factual knowledge narrowly relevant to the proposed subject of study. A typical question that I might ask in an interview, derived from Peter Medawar, was, "The artist El Greco had a reputation for painting his figures especially long and thin. It's been suggested that the reason for this is that he had a defect in his vision, which made everything appear stretched in the vertical direction. Do you think that is a plausible theory?" Some students immediately got it, and I would rate them highly. "No, it's a bad theory, because when he looked at his own paintings, they would be even more stretched." Some didn't get it at first, but I was able to coax them through a line of reasoning until they did see the point. Some of them were then clearly intrigued, perhaps annoyed with themselves for not seeing the point straight away, and I'd rate them fairly highly too, as teachable. Some might put up a fight, and I'd give them credit for that too. Perhaps El Greco's vision was defective only when he looked at more distant objects like the model, not when he looked at close objects like his canvas. Others just didn't get the point at all, even when I tried to lead them towards it, and I marked them down as less likely to benefit from an Oxford education. I'm going to expand a little on the kinds of questions that Oxford tutors ask at interview. This is partly because I think the art of interviewing for university entrance is interesting in its own right. But also, if I betray some inside tips, it might actually help prospective students hoping to get into one of those, now rather few, universities that still bother to interview. Here's a similar conundrum to the El Greco question, which I would sometimes use. Why do mirrors reverse from left to right but don't turn the image upside down? And is it a problem in psychology, physics, philosophy, or what? Again, I was mostly testing the teachability of students, their ability to be led through a chain of reasoning, even if they didn't immediately solve the puzzle. Actually, that particular puzzle is surprisingly difficult. It helps if you reframe it and think not about a mirror but about a glass door, say a door in a hotel that has "lobby" written on it. When you see it from the other side, it says "lobby" backwards, not "lobby" upside down. It is easier to explain why this is so for the glass door than for the mirror. Generalizing to the mirror is then straightforward physics, a good example of the value of reframing a problem to make it tractable. Or I might remind them that the image on our retina is upside down, yet we see the world the right way up. Talk me through an explanation for that. Another favourite question to test their biological intuition began, "How many grandparents do you have?" 4. "And how many great-grandparents?" 8. "And how many great-great-grandparents?" 16. Right then, how many ancestors do you think you had 2,000 years ago in the time of Christ? The brighter ones tumble to the fact that you can't go on doubling up indefinitely, because the number of ancestors rapidly overtakes the billions of people in the world now, let alone the comparatively small number that were alive in the time of Christ. That proved to be a good line of reasoning to coax them to the conclusion that we are all cousins, with numerous shared ancestors who lived not so long ago. Another way to put the question might be, how far back in time do you think you'd have to go before you hit an ancestor that you and I share? I treasure the answer given me by one young woman from rural Wales. She looked me up and down with an implacable gaze, and then slowly delivered her verdict. Back to the apes. I'm afraid she didn't get in, although not for that reason. Nor did the young man from a public school, the strange English term for a private school, who lolled back in his chair. The image of him putting his feet on the desk has got to be a false memory, born of the impression he projected, and drawled his reply to one of my best sallies. That's a pretty damn silly question, isn't it? I must say I was tempted by him, but the competition was too stiff, so I recommended him to a pugnacious colleague in another college, who accepted him. That young man later went out to do field research in Africa and was said to have stared down a charging elephant. A colleague in philosophy was fond of this interview question, and I agree that it's a good one. How do you know you aren't dreaming at this moment? Another colleague liked this one. A monk, not sure why it had to be a monk just to give colour, I suppose, set off at dawn to walk up a long, winding path from the bottom to the top of a mountain. It took him all day. When he reached the summit, he spent the night in a mountain hut. Then at the same time next morning, he walked all the way down the same path again to the bottom of the mountain. Can we be sure that there is some particular spot along the path such that the monk passed that spot at exactly the same time on both days? The answer is yes, but not everybody is able to see or explain why. The trick, again, is to reframe it. Imagine that as the monk sets off to walk up the mountain, another monk simultaneously sets off on the reverse journey along the same path from the top to the bottom. Obviously, the two monks have to meet at some particular point along the path at some particular time during the day. I was amused by this conundrum, but I don't think I ever used it in an interview because, once you've got the point, it doesn't, unlike the El Greco question, or the mirror question, or the inverted retinal image question, or indeed the dreaming question, lead on to anything further. But, once again, it illustrates the power of reframing. I suppose it's an aspect of lateral thinking. A question that I never used, but that might be good for testing the sort of mathematical intuition that biologists need, as opposed to mathematical skills like algebraic manipulation or arithmetic calculation, which also do no harm, is this. Why do so many influences, gravity, light, radio waves, sound, etc., obey an inverse square law? As you move away from a source, the strength of the influence diminishes steeply as the square of the distance. Why should this be? One way to express the answer intuitively is this. The influence, whatever it is, radiates outwards in all directions, plastering itself over the inner surface of an expanding sphere. The larger the area of the expanding surface, the more thinly spread the influence is. The area of a sphere, as we remember from Euclidean geometry and could prove if we set our minds to it, but wouldn't bother in the interview, is proportional to the square of the radius, hence the inverse square law. That's mathematical intuition without, necessarily, mathematical manipulation, and it's a valuable quality to look for in a biology student. The interview might proceed to a further, less mathematical but still interesting, discussion of possible biological applications, which would help in judging the teachability of a student. Female silkworm moths attract a mate by emitting a chemical, a pheromone. Males can detect it at an astonishingly great distance. Would we expect the inverse square law to apply here? On the face of it, perhaps yes, but the student might point out that the pheromone will be blown in a particular direction by the wind. How does that affect matters? The student might also point out that, even when there's no wind, the pheromone would not diffuse outwards in an expanding sphere, if only because half of the sphere would be stopped by the ground, and most of the other half would be too high. Which might prompt the tutor to divulge the following intriguing fact, almost certainly unknown to the student. Because of an interaction between pressure and temperature gradients, sound travels through the sea further and more slowly at some depths than at others. There's a layer called the SOFAR channel or sound channel in which, because sound is reflected back into the layer from its margins, it propagates in something more like an expanding ring than an expanding sphere. The distinguished whale expert and conservationist Roger Payne reckons that when whales with a very loud song position themselves in the sound channel, their songs could theoretically be heard right across the Atlantic, itself a captivating idea to inspire the student being interviewed. Would the inverse square law apply to these whale songs? If the sound were plastered over the inside of an expanding ring, the student might reason that the area of plastering would be proportional to something closer to the radius than the square of the radius, circumference of circle directly proportional to radius. But it obviously wouldn't be a perfectly flat circle. A legitimate answer to the question, and one that I'd applaud, would be, "This is getting too complicated for my intuition. Let's phone a physicist." Like, I think, most college tutors, I developed a loyalty to many of the candidates I interviewed. I was unwillingly obliged to reject far more than half of them, and it often hurt me to do so. I would make strenuous efforts to see them placed in other Oxford colleges, urging on colleagues the virtues of my candidates. I used to resent it when another college accepted from its own list of applicants a candidate whom I thought clearly less qualified than one whom we, at New College, had had to reject through sheer force of numbers. But I suppose my colleagues had the same loyalties to their candidates. The Oxford system of allowing all the colleges to admit candidates separately has little to be said in its favour and much against. My guess is that the sheer complexity of the system puts not a few candidates off applying to Oxford at all, and that's a better reason for being put off than the absurd misperception that Oxford is posh or snobbish, as it admittedly used to be, but is no longer, quite the reverse. For most of my adult life, I have looked younger than I am, a point we'll come back to in the chapter on television, and this led to an amusing incident during one interview season. Exhausted and parched after a whole day of interviewing entrance candidates, I repaired to the King's Arms pub just outside New College. I was standing at the bar waiting for my beer when a tall young man came striding over, put his arm sympathetically around my shoulder and said, "Well, how did you get on then?" I recognised him as one of the candidates I'd just interviewed. He must have remembered my face, too, as one that he'd seen during the day and thought I was one of his rivals. Andrew Pomiankowski won his place at New College, got an exceptionally high first-class degree, went on to do a DPhil, Oxford and Sussex speak for PhD, with John Maynard Smith at Sussex University, and is now a professor of evolutionary genetics at University College London. He was just one of many very clever pupils whom it was my privilege to teach. Here's another story of an outstanding pupil well-suited to the tutorial system. When I was tutoring in my room in New College, I often overran the hour and my next student would wait outside. I hadn't realised that my voice was audible through the door until, on one occasion, I was holding forth on some topic or other, when the door suddenly burst open and the next student came charging in, shouting indignantly, "No, no, no, I really cannot agree with that." All credit to Simon Baron Cohen. I'm sure he was right and I was wrong. He is now a professor at Cambridge, famous for his pioneering work on autism, if a little less famous than his cousin Sacha Baron Cohen, the amusingly scandalising actor. My graduate student, star pupil, and indeed later mentor Alan Graffen, of whom much more in later chapters, was not one of my own New College undergraduates, but his friend and collaborator Mark Ridley was. Less mathematical than Alan, Mark is a prodigiously knowledgeable scholar, historian of biology, synthesizer, critical thinker, learned reader, and elegantly stylish writer. He went on to write many important books, including what was to become one of the two leading textbooks of evolution, the kind that American campus bookstores seem to order by the cubic yard, restocking with new editions at regular intervals. Alan and Mark have worked together on several occasions, including one field project on albatrosses, camping on a Galapagos island with a very clever young woman from Germany, Kati Rechten. Alan later told me that when he and Mark were flying out to Galapagos together, he became aware of a strange low murmuring sound coming from the next seat. On investigation, it turned out to be Mark reciting Latin poetry to himself. Yes, that's Mark, and no doubt he got the quantities right on the elegiac couplets. Also very Mark is his acknowledgement in his first book to Professor Southwood, who stood in as thesis supervisor, when Richard Dawkins was away in the plantations for two sabbatic terms. The plantations meant Florida. Mark is not to be confused with his contemporary at Oxford, Matt Ridley, no known relationship, although Matt investigated and established that they are in the same Y chromosome tribe. I count both as dear friends. Both are first-class biologists and successful writers. On one occasion, a journal editor succeeded in getting them to review each other's books in the same issue without telling them. Each was complimentary about the other, and Mark wrote that Matt's book would be an excellent addition to our joint CV. In 1984, Mark and I accepted the invitation of Oxford University Press to be the founding editors of a new annual journal, Oxford Surveys in Evolutionary Biology. We only lasted 3 years in the job before handing our baby over to Paul Harvey and Linda Partridge. But we were pretty pleased with the distinguished authors we managed to capture during those 3 years. Papers were commissioned rather than submitted, together with a star-studded editorial board to grace the title page. At the end of my undergraduates' Oxford careers, I took very seriously my role in coaching them for their final examinations. American students typically sit an exam at the end of every term in every course they take, and often a midterm exam as well. Oxford is very different. Apart from informal tests called collections, which are administered separately by the various colleges to monitor progress and have no official standing, most Oxford students have no proper exams at all between the end of their first year and the end of their third. Everything is packed into the terrible ordeal of finals, an ordeal exacerbated by the requirement that they dress up in sub-fusc for the occasion. In my time, this dress code was dark suit and white bow tie for men, dark skirt, white shirt and black tie for women, black academic gown, black academic cap or mortarboard. Since 2012, the authorities have found a neat form of words to proclaim a politically acceptable sex blindness. Students identifying as either sex can wear historically male or female clothes. Adding to the intimidating atmosphere of sub-fusc is the strict invigilation. Officially, students wishing to visit the men's or women's room have to be escorted by a minder of the same sex to make sure they don't cheat by looking things up while there. But by the time I came to be an invigilator, we usually didn't bother with that rule. At least in my time, there was no need to frisk examinees for internet-capable mobile phones, as there presumably must be today. The whole performance is calculated to terrify, and nervous breakdowns are not uncommon around the time of finals. My colleague David McFarland, tutor in psychology at Balliol College, was once telephoned by the invigilator in the examination room. "We're getting concerned about your pupil, Mr. Blank. Since the exam began, his handwriting has been growing steadily larger, and each letter is now 3 inches across." I saw it as the duty of a college tutor to see students at frequent intervals during their last term, to hold their hands through the ordeal of finals and the weeks of revision leading up to it. I would take the whole cohort together in my room for regular coaching in exam technique, and I made them do lots of mock exam questions, each in exactly 1 hour. The self-imposed time limit was important. In each of their written papers, they would have 3 hours to write 3 essays, chosen from about 12 on offer. In our joint counselling sessions, I urged them not to deviate too far from allocating equal time, 1 hour, to each of the 3 essays. I was exaggerating a little in the interest of warning them how many students under pressure fall into the trap of getting carried away with a favourite topic, devoting most of their time to it, and leaving no time to answer less preferred questions. "Suppose you were the world authority on the topic of your favourite question," I suggested. "You couldn't write down more than a small fraction of what you knew." With a nod to Ernest Hemingway, I advocated iceberging. 9/10 of an iceberg is submerged. If you are the world authority on a topic, you could write about it till kingdom come, but you've only got 1 hour, like everybody else. So cunningly exhibit the tip of your iceberg and let the examiner infer the huge quantity that lies beneath the surface. Say, "Notwithstanding Brown and McAllister's objection," and convey to the examiner that you could, if you had time, go to town on Brown and McAllister. Do not actually do so, because that would take too long and leave you no time for all the other iceberg summits that you need to skip on to. Just the name drop does the business. The examiner will fill in the rest. It's important to add that iceberging works only because we assume that the examiner knows a lot. Iceberging is a terrible technique in, say, instruction manuals, where the author knows what is being imparted, but the reader does not. Steven Pinker makes the point forcibly as "the curse of knowledge" in his splendid book, The Sense of Style. When you are actually trying to explain something to somebody who knows less than you do, iceberging is the exact opposite of what you should be doing. It works in exams solely because it is fair to presume that your reader is an examiner who knows a lot. When I was an undergraduate myself, the wise and learned Harold Pusey took me and a group of contemporaries for similar coaching, and iceberging was one of the tips he gave us. I think his metaphor was not actually icebergs, but shop windows, and it works just as well. An impressive shop window is sparsely furnished. A few tasteful items elegantly presented evoke the riches stashed away inside the store. A good window dresser doesn't clutter the window with everything in the shop. Another of Mr. Pusey's tips. Yes, mister, he was a don of the old school who never bothered with a doctorate, which I passed on verbatim to my own students, was this. When you've read the exam paper and spotted a favourite topic, don't immediately start writing that essay. First decide which three of the 12 questions you're going to tackle, then make a written plan for all three essays, each on a separate sheet, before you start writing any one of them. While you're writing your first essay, you will find that ideas for the other two continually occur to your primed mind. When that happens, jot down a note on the appropriate one of your three sheets of paper. Then, when you come to answer your second and third questions, you'll find that much of the thinking work has already been done, at almost no cost in time. I'm told that this tip is also pertinent to American students taking the advanced placement exam. I didn't have the courage to pass on another of Harold's pieces of advice. Stop revising a whole week before your final exam start. Spend the last week punting on the river and let it all sink in. I did, though, tell them yet another piece of his wisdom. During your weeks of Oxford finals, you'll probably have more concentrated knowledge in your head than at any other time in your life. Your task while revising is to systematize it while it simmers. Seek connections and relationships between different parts of your knowledge base. During my years in the zoology department, I also took my turn as examiner from time to time, and a very heavy responsibility it is. Quite apart from the hard work involved, you cannot escape the grave knowledge that your decisions are going to affect the whole future lives of promising and eager young people. Some unfairnesses are built into the system. The students end up classified into one of three discrete classes, although everybody knows that the bottom of one class is much closer to the top of the class below than it is to the top of its own class. I wrote about this in The Tyranny of the Discontinuous Mind, in New Statesman when I was guest editor. See E Appendix, and I won't spell the argument out again here. But there are other unfairnesses that an examiner can and should do something about. How sure can you be that the order in which you read the scripts is unimportant? Are you getting fatigued as you read paper after paper? Is your standard of judgment drifting, either upwards or downwards, as a result? Or if not physically fatigued, are you getting progressively bored by the inevitable familiarity as answer after answer to the same popular question thuds into your consciousness? Does this give an unfair advantage to candidates who choose unpopular questions? Is that advantage unfair? Does the boredom or fatigue effect give an unfair advantage to those essays that you read early, or to those that you read late? I tried to guard against order effects by using some of the elementary principles that all biologists learn in designing experiments. Don't read all three of the first candidate's essays, then all three of the second, and so on. Instead, read everybody's first essay, then everybody's second essay, then everybody's third essay. And on each of your three runs through the scripts, it might be no bad thing to read them in random order, not the same order every time. Then again, are you seduced by the elegant handwriting of this candidate and prejudiced against the untidy scrawl of that one, a virtue or fault that has no bearing on the quality of scholarship? Or does it? My first wife, Marion, and I were both examiners at various times during our careers in the Oxford Zoology Department, and we tried the experiment of reading the essays aloud to each other. That should have gone some way towards eliminating the handwriting effect, and it had additional advantages. At the end of a reading, without comment to each other, we would simultaneously, on a count of three, so as not to influence each other, sing out the mark that each of us thought the essay deserved. We were both reassured by the high concordance between our separate marks. All Oxford papers are in any case double marked, marked by two separate readers, without collusion, which is a good attempt at safeguarding against certain types of unfairness. Also, nowadays, this didn't happen when I was an examiner, the candidates' names are disguised, and they are known only by randomised numbers. This guards against personal biases, either for or against, and it matters in a small department like zoology, where most of the students are known personally to the examiners. I had occasion to worry about order effects in other decision-making tasks, for example, when I was on committees to choose new lecturers or fellows, or in judging prizes or awards. The Royal Society awards an annual Michael Faraday Prize for success in promoting science to the general public. I won it in 1990 and was later put on the committee to choose the prize winner. The committee has a rolling membership, and I served as chairman for the last 3 of my 5 years. In the first 2 years, with my predecessor as chairman, I was worried about order effects. Each candidate had a dossier consisting of curriculum vitae and letters of support. We had all read the dossiers conscientiously before the meeting. So far, so good. But then in committee, we discussed all of them in order, probably alphabetical order, which makes it worse, but that's not the point I'm making here. Whatever ordering principle you choose, order effects are inevitable. It was distinctly noticeable that the first few dossiers were given lengthy discussion, and the length of discussion tailed off as the afternoon wore on. This was especially unfortunate when we would spend a lot of time near the beginning discussing the minute details of a candidate who turned out to be a no-hoper, with no support from any member of the committee. When I became chairman, I changed the system in a way that I recommend for all such committees, and therefore think is worth explaining fully here. Before the committee began any discussion at all, each one of us, having read the dossiers before we arrived, wrote secretly on a piece of paper the names of the 3 candidates whom we would wish to discuss first, along with a score, 3 points for our top candidate, 2 marks for the next, 1 mark for the third. I then gathered all the slips of paper, added up the points, and announced the rank order. I clearly explained to the committee that this was not a ballot to determine the prize winner. It was a ballot solely to determine the order in which we would discuss the candidates. We then discussed the dossiers properly and in detail, but the order in which we did so was not alphabetical and not reverse alphabetical, which is sometimes used in a vain but futile attempt to counter the known advantage the A's and C's have over the T's and W's. Not arbitrary at all, but determined by our preliminary secret ballot. After our full discussion, we then proceeded to our final secret ballot rounds to choose the winner. The eventual winner might turn out to be the same candidate who atopped the preliminary order ballot, but it might not. The exhaustive discussion during the afternoon could well change people's minds. Under the old system, the lion's share of the discussion time was squandered on candidates who never had any hope anyway. The new system meant that we had time to discuss more thoroughly those who did have at least some support and to discuss them in a just order. Subwarden. To serve on the committees that chose new lecturers and fellows was one of the serious responsibilities of my life at Oxford. There were others: financial, pastoral, custodial. A fellowship at a typical Oxford or Cambridge college brings with it trusteeship of a large charitable institution, making investments and disbursements that, in the case of a relatively wealthy foundation like New College, could be quite substantial. In addition, the fellows were, as a group, responsible for student welfare and discipline, for the upkeep of the chapel and other precious medieval buildings, and for much else besides. We elected officers from among our number to oversee each of the main functions. I was happily and rightly never elected to any office. I would have been hopelessly bad. However, there is one office no fellow of New College can escape: subwarden. Other Oxbridge colleges may elect a vice-warden, vice-master, vice-principal, vice-provost, etc., depending on the bewilderingly variable names that Oxford colleges choose for their heads, a colleague whom all respect to deputise for the head of the college. That isn't New College's way. We don't elect our subwarden. It is a one-year burden which descends inexorably down the list of fellows, and respect doesn't come into it. Every year until the black spot hit me in 1989, I was able to count off the years of its approach. That count was always a maximum figure. A year was ominously knocked off it every time a colleague ahead of me in the list died, or, which was pretty common, left to take a professorship elsewhere. Ominously because I dreaded it. The onerous nature of the sub-warden's duties is justified by their brevity, only 1 year out of your life. As sub-warden, I had to attend all committee meetings, and that meant all subcommittees and all appointing and electing committees, as well as the full college meetings, where I had to write the minutes. As it turned out, I quite enjoyed my minutes, using them as a vehicle to try to amuse my colleagues, those who read them, which was by no means all, as we sometimes discovered during the subsequent meeting. The sub-warden has to take the chair when the warden is unavoidably absent from college meetings, or when the warden has to recuse himself from a discussion that concerns him personally. The role is a particularly weighty responsibility when the college is electing a new warden, for the sub-warden of the day has to preside over the whole voting procedure. Thank goodness this didn't happen on my watch. In all the 4 wardenship elections in which I participated, the sub-warden of the day either happened to be well qualified or rose to the occasion. In one case, some smart footwork ensured that the year of office of a notoriously unstable, not to say downright misanthropic fellow, was somehow postponed in favour of a respected, safe pair of hands. Incidentally, my lack of skill as a political operator is indicated by the fact that in 3 of those 4 elections, I nominated the runner-up. As sub-warden, I had to preside over dinner in hall and say grace before Benedictus Benedicat and after Benedicto Benedicata. I was one of the majority who pronounced this last word Benedicata. Some of the older, classically trained fellows pronounced it Benedicator, which fascinated me, although I never dared follow them. I doubt that they really thought that's how the Romans pronounced it, but their justification was surely thought out and deliberate, probably buried in some erstwhile dispute among the domines. One of my predecessors as sub-warden, the ancient historian Geoffrey de St. Croix, used to refuse to say grace on conscientious grounds. He described himself as an atheist politely militant. Equally conscientiously, however, he went out of his way to line somebody up to say it for him. Once, when I was a dinner guest at King's, our sister college at Cambridge, whose chapel, incidentally, is one of the most beautiful buildings in England, the senior fellow presiding was the incomparable Sidney Brenner, one of the founding fathers of molecular genetics and winner of a well-deserved, they aren't always, Nobel Prize. Sidney gavelled everybody to stand, then solemnly intoned to his neighbour, "Dr. Blank, will you please say grace?" I, however, was of the school of thought of the great philosopher Sir Alfred Eyre, who, when sub-warden of New College, cheerfully said grace on the grounds that, "I will not utter falsehoods, but I have no objection to making meaningless statements." I was once fiercely attacked for adopting the same stance by Rabbi Julia Neuberger, one of Britain's best-known rabbis and a well-established member of the Great and Good, both a dame and a member of the House of Lords. She sat next to me at a rather formal luncheon and furiously accused me of hypocrisy when she dragged out of me that I was prepared to say grace when presiding in New College Hall. I countered that, although it meant a lot to her, it meant nothing to me, so why should I object? It seemed to me a matter of simple courtesy, like removing your shoes when entering a Hindu or a Buddhist temple. Wasn't I right simply to honour an ancient tradition? Although actually I'm not sure that Benedictus Benedicat is all that ancient. Does it perhaps, like so many ancient traditions, go back no further than the 19th century? Once, at the beginning of a dinner in Wellington College, after a debate with, among others, the Bishop of Oxford, the philosopher A.C. Grayling, and the journalist Charles Moore, who for some reason brought a brace of shotguns to the occasion, the master, the justly celebrated Anthony Seldon, jovially invited me to say a secular grace. Put on the spot, I couldn't think fast enough to do any better than, "For what we are about to receive, thank the cook." Most daunting of the sub-warden's duties was making speeches, usually for the purpose of welcoming new fellows or saying farewell to departing ones. It was the speeches that I especially dreaded as my year of tribulation approached, having heard some pretty poor sub-warden turns, along with some good ones. As it turned out, I could do it, although not off the cuff. I had to spend lots of time preparing my speeches in advance, and in this I was greatly helped by the more spontaneously witty Helena Cronin, philosopher and historian of science at the London School of Economics, who was my close collaborator at the time. We were helping each other to write our respective books, as I shall explain later. Making speeches about new fellows is difficult because it's in the nature of their newness that one doesn't know them and has to rely for material on their written curricula vitae. The CV of a new law fellow, Suzanne Gibson, for example, announced a professional interest in the body as a visual and narrative structure. I had a bit of fun with that, hamming up the role of a hypothetical future barrister trained in law at New College. My learned friend has presented evidence that my client was seen burying a body at dead of night. But, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I put it to you that a body is a visual and narrative structure. You cannot convict a man on evidence of burying nothing more than a visual and narrative structure. Susie was a good sport who took it well, and we later became close friends. Another new fellow whom I had to introduce that evening was Wes Williams, a scholar of French who became a valued colleague. We already had two other Williamses, so I was able to make something of this. For years we had only a single Williams on the fellowship. We soldiered on, but it didn't look good, and I'm afraid it was a long time before we managed to get a second Williams. I am therefore delighted this evening to welcome our third Williams, and I can officially announce that all future election committees will include at least one token Williams to see fair play. These welcoming speeches always take place at dessert, the quaint ceremony of formal dessert, a version of which is observed in most Oxbridge colleges, and which I never liked, takes place in a separate room after dinner, where port and claret, sauterne and hock, have to pass clockwise around the circle, and nuts, fruit and chocolates are handed round by the most junior fellows. New College has a curious contraption called the Port Railway, dating, as you might expect, from the 19th century, which is supposed to, and occasionally does, convey bottles and decanters by a pulley system across the gap in the circle, which is the fireplace. Snuff also is traditionally handed round, but seldom actually taken, at least since the days of one venerable and long-retired fellow whose consequent prodigious sneezes would reverberate companionably around the oak panelling for the rest of the evening. Although the sub-warden doesn't have to seat fellows and their guests, as the presiding fellow does in some other colleges, he is expected to beam the role of genial host at dessert. I did my best, but there was one awkward evening. As I was helping people to find their seats, I became aware from a sort of ominous rumbling that all was not well. Sir Michael Dummett, immensely distinguished philosopher, Wickham Professor of Logic in succession to Freddie Eyre, stickler for grammar, conscientious and passionate campaigner against racism, world authority on card games and voting theory, was also famously choleric. When angered, he would go even more than usually white, which somehow seemed, though this may be my fevered imagination, to make his eyes glow a menacing red, pretty terrifying, and it was my duty as sub-warden to try to sort out whatever this problem was. The rumble grew to a roar. "I've never been so insulted in my life. You have the most atrocious manners. You obviously must be an Etonian." The target of this damning sally was not me, thank goodness, but our quirkily brilliant classical historian, Robin Lane Fox. Robin was hopping with anxiety and bewildered apology. "But what have I done? What have I done?" I didn't immediately succeed in discovering what the problem was, but in my hostly role, I saw to it that the two of them were seated as far from each other as possible. I later learned the full story. It had begun at lunchtime that day. Lunch is an informal self-service meal, and fellows sit where they like, although it is conventional to fill up the tables in order. Robin noticed that a new fellow was hesitantly looking for a place. He courteously motioned her to sit, but unfortunately the chair he indicated was the very chair for which Sir Michael was heading himself. The perceived slight rankled, simmered up through the afternoon, and finally boiled over after dinner at dessert. The story had a happier ending, as Robin told me when I asked him recently. A couple of days after that distressing incident, he was approached by Professor Dummett, who offered the most gracious apology, saying that there was nobody in the college whom he would less wish to insult than Robin. Thank goodness I was never the target of his ire, although I might have been vulnerable, as he was a devout Roman Catholic with the zeal of the convert. Not that it is at all relevant, Robin Lane Fox does happen to be an Etonian. You may know him as the gardening correspondent of the Financial Times and author of Better Gardening, whose chapter on Better Shrubs follows the one on Better Trees with this deliciously anachronistic and utterly characteristic opening salvo. swinging down from the branches to the level of better shrubs, I will not leave the days when the world was young and dawn redwoods dawned among the dinosaurs. Among mastodons and dimetrodons, what could be more natural than my own dying species, the Oxford Ancient History Don? Though long declared moribund, we are far from extinct. World authority on Alexander the Great and enthusiastic horseman, he agreed to advise Oliver Stone on filming the epic Alexander, on condition that he was allowed to appear as an extra leading the cavalry charge. And he did. It has been a privilege of my career to have been surrounded by such idiosyncratically unpredictable colleagues who would make even committee meetings entertaining. I could tell parallel stories of many such colleagues and friends, but will desist. One will have to stand for all, although I suppose that belies the very meaning of idiosyncrasy. I have great affection for New College and for many friends made there over the years. I feel pretty sure I'd say the same if the roll of the dice had placed me in another college, or indeed a Cambridge college, for these very similar institutions are wonderful places, mixing scholars in different subjects, but sharing the same academic and educational values, values from which I like to think the students benefit. Quirky individuality nevertheless abounds, and Oxbridge colleges are famously hard to govern, as many an incoming head from the big world outside has discovered. Yes, we have our share of scholarly prima donnas, clever but not necessarily as clever as their vanity persuades them. And we have the reverse, a scholar so lacking in vanity as laughingly to tell at lunch a story like this against himself. I was telephoned by the student newspaper today. Dr. Blank, have you any comment on the fact that in your lecture this morning, one of the students yawned so vigorously that he dislocated his jaw? As it happens, the same student newspaper, Charwell, pronounced like the Oxford River after which it is named, once telephoned me when it was doing a survey of dons to see how cool we were. The student reporter put to me a list of questions to assess my street cred, such as, what is the price of a packet of Durex? And then, what is the price of a Big Mac? To which, in my naivety, I replied, oh, about £2,000 with a colour screen. He was laughing too much to continue the interview and put the phone down. In one of my speeches as sub-warden of New College, I had to bid farewell to the chaplain, Jeremy Sheehy, who, as was the custom in those days, was moving on to a Church of England living. We had often voted together on the liberal side of contentious issues, and I mentioned in my speech a political affinity with him that I sensed at college meetings, catching his eye in concord across the abyss of our differences. At the time, the New College kitchen was in the habit of serving a rather delicious pudding, a sort of moist, black, cakey sponge, topped by a creamy white sauce, but it always appeared on the menu under an unfortunate name, Nègre en chemise. The Reverend Jeremy was repeatedly and rightly upset by this, and I wanted, as my parting gift to him, to get the name changed. I went to the chef, one of the few powers possessed by the sub-warden, and asked him to serve the dish up at dinner, but under a new name. In my speech at dessert that night, I told the story and explained that I had chosen the new name in the chaplain's honour, Prêtre en surplice. Alas, after he left, it wasn't long before the delicacy started to reappear under the original name, Nègre en chemise, and by then I no longer had sub-warden's powers to do anything about it. Incidentally, I heard of a related problem at a care home for old people in England. One day the menu included a traditional English pudding, the long, raisin-infested, custard-bespattered suet roll called Spotted Dick. The local government inspector demanded that it be banned from the bill of fare, as its name was sexist. The arduous climax to the sub-warden's oratorical career at New College is the speech at the Gordy, the annual reunion dinner, to which a different cohort of old members is invited each year. The choice of age group marches backwards a few years at a time with, in deference to the Grim Reaper, lengthening stride as vintage gives way to veteran, and eventually we hit the old Gordy, which embraces everybody who came up to New College before some early cut-off date. Then the cycle begins again with the young Gordy, those who left the college only a decade or so ago. As it happened, in my year as sub-warden, the cycle had reached the old Gordy, but their depleting numbers, alas, couldn't fill the tables, so they were afforced by new blood from the young Gordy, callow youths in their 30s. and so I faced the difficult task of appealing to guests, one half of whom were separated from the other half by a world war, a Great Depression, and about 50 years. Not an easy speech to compose. I tried to play on the contrast between the Roaring Twenties, when the old contingent had been undergraduates, and the 1970s, which, at least by contrast with my own era, the 1960s, could, at a pardonable stretch, be regarded as somewhat staid. Describing myself as having reached the lunchtime of life, I cobbled together something about gilded age meeting crabbed youth, which I think pleased the old, while not seriously annoying the young, who perhaps didn't believe it anyway. I tried to arouse nostalgia in the oldies, coupled with incredulous amusement in their young successors, by reading from the Junior Common Room, JCR, Suggestions book of the 1920s, which the college archivist kindly lent me. Incredulity, for example, on discovering that apparently many of the baths in the 1920s were in one great hall with cubicles, as testified by the several letters that said things like, "Would the gentleman who was attempting unsuccessfully to sing in the fifth bath on the left this morning please refrain in future?" Incredulity, too, perhaps, at the presumptuous treatment of college servants, tell-tale badge of the haughty brideshead generation that emphatically no longer typifies the Oxford colleges, with the possible exception of the much-despised Bullingdon set. "If one wants a plate of cucumber sandwiches sent up to one's rooms for tea, I understand the kitchen requires notice before 11 a.m. This is most inconvenient." Would it be possible for either the boot cleaner or the bath attendant to scrape the mud off the football boots and, if necessary, grease them in the bathroom? There were many complaints about the door of the JCR squeaking. I'd like to think that the 1970s cohort might quietly have applied a drop of oil to the hinge, rather than braying for someone else to do it for them. But mostly, the appeal of my quotations was gentle nostalgia for a bygone age. Would it be possible for a new pair of hairbrushes, really hard, and a new comb to be provided in the old bathroom? May I suggest that pipe cleaners be provided in JCR? These articles strike me as being more useful than toothpicks. Wishing to telephone this morning, I was surprised to find the telephone box missing. What can have happened to it? May I add, as a suggestion to be conveyed to the right quarter, that there seems to be no particular reason to replace it? I think my speech went down quite well. One of the old brigade wrote a thank you letter to the warden, which said it reminded him of his old tutor, Lord David Cecil. It seemed to be meant as a compliment, although Kingsley Amis's recollections in his autobiography of that aristocratic savant give me pause.